What's up, traders? Anthony Crudelli here, and thank you for tuning in to the Futures Radio Show podcast. In today's episode, I'm joined by Darius Dale. He is the founder and CEO of 42 Macro, offering a comprehensive proprietary model that helps investors manage risk and receive portfolio guidance through macro forecasting models and quantitative signals. In today's episode, we explore the sticky inflation theme and its effects on various asset classes and investment strategies. We'll also discuss expectations for rate cuts, key macroeconomic factors, and Darius Dale's perspective on gold and commodities. If you're a trader or investor seeking an in-depth analysis of the current market landscape, you won't want to miss this conversation. Today's podcast is sponsored by FTSE Russell and TradeStation. FTSE Russell is the home of the Russell 2000 Index. Did you know that with an 81% share and $1.6 trillion in institutional assets benchmarked, the Russell 2000 is the top choice by far among institutional investors? Like all Russell U.S. indexes, it's rules-based, transparent, and reliable. Regularly updated with the latest IPOs and annually rebalanced. To learn more about FTSE Russell and their products, please go to FTSERussell.com. Serious futures traders, level up your skills with TradeStation's powerful platform. Enjoy flexibility, superior trading power, and save big with 50% off brokerage fees for the life of your account and get 10% intraday margin rates on three popular futures markets. Open a new futures account today at TradeStation.com/Anthony. So, DD, great to have you back on the show, my brother.
Anthony, man, it's such a pleasure to be back with you, man. I always love chopping it up with you, brother.
No, I love chatting with you. I'm a huge fan of your work. You've taught me a lot, and we're here really on a special day for you and really a special day for the markets. I think we just got to get right into it. I mean, we finally are starting to see markets react to some inflationary data that we've been getting. You continue to see rates upticking here. I think it is a factor. And obviously geopolitical headwinds, it's not like they've really been too quiet. I mean, what people forget, there's still a war going on in Ukraine and with Russia. And you also have, you know, things obviously really getting very tense in the Middle East. It's and the market, I think, is starting to react to all of these things. What say you?
Yeah, I think that's the general perception out there, is that the market is starting to react to that. From our perspective, I think this was a long time coming. One of the things we did heading into the month of April was flag for our clients that our positioning model was flagging the elevated risk of a tactical pullback in asset market. And part of the reason for that is the shorter term, more tactical indicators that we feature in our positioning model, namely things like the AI bulls bear spread. We look at implied correlations, but the AI cash allocation, those types of more tactical indicators were suggesting that this is a market that was very overstretched from the perspective of, you know, kind of short-term price momentum. And so from our perspective, whether it be a deterioration in the, you know, the Israel-Hamas war and what's going on in the Middle East or any other geopolitical activity, any other negative geopolitical catalyst, in our opinion, you know, whether it be that or a squirrel getting hit by a bus, we would have had a pullback in asset market from our perspective. Now, from a medium-term perspective, we are still in a risk on reflation market regime. And in our, from our perspective, in our humble, you know, opinion, it's going to be, you're going to be hard pressed to undo a risk on market regime with mere geopolitical catalysts alone. What you need to do in order to undo that risk on market regime is actually cause the themes that have really contributed to that regime to go by the wayside. And there are four themes currently that are active that are continuing to contribute to that outcome. And so number one would be the resilient U.S. economy theme that we authored in the summer of 2022, that's persistent. Number two would be the China front-loading stimulus theme that we authored in mid-December of 2023, that it persists. Our green shoots globally theme, which we authored in January, that persists. And then our Jay and Janet want a soft landing theme, which dates back to December in terms of the Fed and Treasury looking like they want to continue to supply liquidity to asset markets, at least here in this election year, that is persistent. I think you need to get rid of one or more of those themes in order to have what we call a row phase transition, which is going from a risk on and or risk off market regime to the opposite condition. And I don't know that we're there yet.
So what is or has been your recommendation in terms of positioning for these themes?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm showing is a screenshot of our risk management process. So in terms of how we help clients stay on the right side of market risk, you know, it's a three-step process, and I'll get to answer your question in the second half of this. But the first step is identifying and positioning for the market regime. As I mentioned, we're currently in a risk-on reflation market regime. The second step of that process is helping investors prepare for regime change using quantitative signals. We do that with our macro weather model, which is a rolling 3-month return projection for each of the major asset classes. And then we help investors prepare for regime change using qualitative signals, i.e. the signals that we just talked about, those fundamental themes. And so to answer your question specifically, Anthony, when we are in a risk-on reflation market regime, you generally want to be long risk assets, short defensive assets. High beta tends to outperform low beta. Cyclicals tend to outperform defensives. Growth tends to outperform value. Small and mid caps tend to outperform large caps. International tends to outperform U.S. Emerging markets tend to outperform developed markets. Within the fixed income markets, threat products tend to outperform treasuries. If you're going to be in the treasury curve, short rates tend to outperform the belly, which tend to outperform long rates, which all three have negative absolute returns. High yield tends to outperform investment grade. And in the commodity space, industrial commodities tend to outperform energy commodities, which tend to outperform ag commodities, but they all have positive absolute returns. And then in the currency market, the foreign currencies tend to outperform the U.S. dollar. And so from my perspective, you know, when you're in any market regime, generally speaking, the bets that you're making as an investor, at least at the bare minimum, the incremental bets, but we'd argue most of the bets you should be making should be in accordance with these factor long short preferences. And so from my perspective, you know, trying to identify whether or not, okay, this is the start of a new regime or not, has less to do with, you know, sort of this short-term tactical pullback that we're seeing in asset markets. And again, more to do with the fact weather model and our qualitative research suggesting about regime change on a go-forward basis. And to, you know, going back to our conclusion earlier, we have not observed enough data fundamentally, nor have we even observed enough deterioration in either our global macro risk matrix, which we use to nowcast the market regime, or the macro weather model, which we use to, you know, roll that market regime nowcast into the future. We have not seen enough change yet to say we need to do something, investors need to do something materially different in their portfolio. So just deal with the correction as it comes.
So what are the most significant macroeconomic factors influencing the market today? And does your model account for variables such as the geopolitical risk and the potential impact for even an election year, which is going to start heating up here, DD?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So yes, our model accounts for everything, right? So let me go back into the slide deck where we show our global macro risk matrix. And so we use our global macro risk matrix to nowcast the market regime. And how this process works is we are scoring each of the 42 most important asset markets, at least from my own anecdotal perspective and my experience on Global Wall Street. We're scoring each of them from the perspective of our volatility adjusted momentum signal. And they were doing that in the context of how the asset has historically performed in each of those grid regimes, Goldilocks, reflation, inflation, and deflation, with inflation and deflation being the risk-off regimes, and Goldilocks and reflation being the risk-on regimes. And so in terms of how this process works, is we are, you know, again, every day, we score the volatility adjusted momentum signal for that particular asset, and then relate that back to how the asset is historically performed based on our backtesting. And so right now, the bullish VAMPS indication for the S&P 500 today gives a point to each Goldilocks and reflation, because the S&P does have positive absolute returns in those regimes. You know, for example, so right now, this morning, the UK 1-year overnight index swap rate just broke back out to bullish, joining a lot of other fixed income rates and spreads over the past few weeks in terms of breaking out. And that gives 1 point to both inflation and reflation, because historically you've seen positive returns in that particular macro factor throughout the lifetime of the backtest. And so, you know, to answer your question, you know, have we seen some changes, or, you know, kind of what in our process would help us identify those changes? It's all 42 of these markets, right? You know, I'm a pretty smart, intelligent guy. You are as well, Anthony. But the reality is, not the two of us are not smarter than any one of these markets, let alone the 42 markets combined together. And so doing this iterative process on a daily basis for our clients, we can identify in real time, hey, what the market regime is. Currently, it's reflation. 25 of those 42 markets are confirming it. That's the highest share of the total. And more importantly, which I think in terms of helping us stay on the right side of market risk, or keeping our clients on the right side of market risk, is identifying when that changes. Specifically, for instance, you know, back in November, when it changed from a risk off inflation to risk on Goldilocks, we said, hey, it's time to get very long, max bullish, do all the things that you would typically need to do in a Goldilocks regime, which is very similar to a reflation regime from a factor dispersion perspective. And then 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, we said, hey, we're no longer in Goldilocks. It's inflation, similar factor dispersion purposes, but you got to get inclinating more short fixed income. And so eventually, you know, something like inflation or deflation will creep up and become the new dominant regime. But for now, you know, we don't think it's appropriate as investors to do something materially different in your portfolio until we observe that change, right? Because again, the volatility adjusted momentum signal, which is the primary tool we're using to score each of these markets, is a leading indicator for big phase transitions in price momentum and asset markets. And so that's why this process works.
Got it. I want to stay on inflation because, you know, following your stuff, you've mentioned that the March CPI and PPI data confirm that sticky inflation theme. Am I right on that?
That is very much correct, my friend. I mean, pick your indicator. I mean, I guess the most important, one of the more important ones, if you look at Supercore CPI, that number accelerated to 7.9% through month annualized, that tripled the pre-COVID trend and obviously moving in the wrong direction as it relates to the Fed's 2% inflation target. So, you know, pretty much every material subcategory of CPI, PPI, and also the leading indicators like the NFIB survey or the University of Michigan survey that we got on Friday. You know, last week was a really challenging week for the immaculate disinflation narrative. We officially said the immaculate disinflation narrative is dead. And really, in our opinion, our Jay and Janet want a soft landing theme, which is the key takeaway of that theme is the Fed is more dovish than it needs to be. And the Treasury market is doing positive things on the perspective of liquidity in this election year. As long as those two things can be remain ongoing or persistent, then we don't have to necessarily be worried about the advent of sticky inflation as investors, because ultimately we're just going to get a more higher nominal GDP economy that the Fed isn't doing anything about or the Treasury isn't doing anything about. It's when they start to do something about it, when investors start to really price in a more trending risk-off condition in asset markets. And again, I'm not sure we're there yet.
So this is really different from where we were in November. And I guess from my perspective, I'm trying to understand if the inflation is sticky, how should investors be perceiving the market? Is this bullish? Is this bearish? Is it just range bound? Is it just come down to Darius? And I think you just said this is that maybe we don't know until the Fed does start to do something or we actually see them really, truly be tested on their word, I think, is something important because they've been talking dovish, like you've mentioned, but are they actually going to do something about it? Or are they going to be in a situation even where we think that they shouldn't cut rates and they do? I mean, I think we're kind of in this unique time where maybe the Fed does get tested here.
Yeah. Again, I think they're going to get tested. I don't think they're going to get tested here in the second quarter because, again, the Fed is already guided to into helping investors understand the disinflation process is going to be bumpy and uneven. That's what we heard in the most recent Fed minutes. That's what Jay Powell stressed in the March FOMC. He also stressed that the Fed is comfortable with inflation returning to 2%, back to the 2% target over time. It's the over time that he's stressing, which if you're reading the tea leaves appropriately, in our opinion, that over time stressing just means that, hey, we are comfortable with inflation being higher than our 2% target for longer. So the higher for longer that asset markets have latched on to, you know, throughout this last, you know, so a couple of quarters is the fact that the Fed is comfortable with higher inflation for longer, which is why they continue to guide to rate cuts. I mean, if you look at the most recent dot plot, talking about 3 rate cuts this year, 3 rate cuts next year, 3 rate cuts the year after that. I mean, the money markets are not as aggressive in terms of what the pricing is. I think the money markets are currently pricing in 2 rate cuts this year, 2 the following year in 2025 and 1 in 2026 before they get to the terminal rate. But that's neither here nor there. But the fact that the Fed is guiding to rate cuts at all in the context of inflation being obviously well above trend and obviously moving in the wrong direction is at least according to the most recent data, in our opinion, suggests that this is a Fed that is acquiescing to fiscal dominance. You know, this is, in our opinion, one of the biggest changes that we've seen from a regime standpoint as investors in recent years is the dominance of the fiscal authority relative to the monetary authority. You know, the 2010s and, you know, the post-crisis era was a real monetary dominant regime in terms of that factor leadership and how you generally wanted to be positioned as an investor. You know, post-COVID era, the regime has been a more of a fiscally dominant regime in which, you know, treasury supply and massively inflated federal budget deficits are having, you know, sort of, I would say, interesting impacts on asset markets and the economy, certainly relative to what we got used to as investors in the prior regime. So I think this is a Fed that is being forced to acquiesce to fiscal dominance. And that result of that is this is a Fed that just is going to accept higher inflation and not going to do anything about it. Now, again, I think inflation, if it misbehaves more materially, like in our model suggested, it's likely to misbehave more materially in Q4 and in Q1 of next year. That's a Fed that may be forced, you know, just from a political standpoint to do something more, i.e. guide to higher for longer on the policy rate front and taking out all those rate cuts, or they could guide to rate hikes potentially in that environment if the economy remains resilient, which we suspect it will be. But again, I don't think we're there yet for this particular discussion. What I think the markets are really latched on to appropriately so, and something we've benefited and our clients have benefited from, is the fact that the Fed is a lot more dovish than current or prospective nominal GDP trends warrant.
And so is that why it's still risk on, in your opinion?
Yeah, for now at least. Yeah, absolutely. Again, risk off could come at any time. I mean, what we try to do here is, as investors, going back to that slide where we're showing our risk management process, we help investors prepare for regime change using quantitative signals. If you look at the current constellation of composite signals in the macro weather model, you know, we have a middling probability of surviving in the risk-on condition over the next 3 months. You know, we're expecting, those macro weather models expecting baseline returns from the stock market, bond market, U.S. dollar commodities over the next 3 months and above baseline returns of Bitcoin. So that's a reasonably positive environment based on the evolution and trends and dispersion across the principal components of macro, whether it be real economy or financial economy. So that's positive. But then when you layer on our fundamental research, which is the second leg of that stool, you know, what's happening, you know, from the side of fundamental research to help investors prepare for regime change. Again, we still have those active themes that are telling investors that, hey, a lot of the positive things that have caused asset markets to, you know, be in this risk-on condition from November through now, those themes are generally still persistent. Now, we lost one of them last week in terms of the death of the immaculate disinflation theme and the birth of the sticky inflation theme. But again, I don't think that in isolation is strong enough to cause a roll phase transition in asset markets, because again, the Fed and the Treasury are not doing anything about it. Once they start doing something about it or guiding to doing something about it, that, in my opinion, is when the risk of a transition from risk on reflation to perhaps risk off inflation is likely to be more salient and more likely and more durable.
I mean, that's one of the things I love about your work is that you stay very much in the moment. Even though you might be projecting forward of potential situations, you're saying right now, this is still the environment. And until you see something actually make that change, where that change actually happens, you stay true to it. Because I think that's one of the most difficult things when you follow people's macro work is that they're projecting so much further away than where we are right now. It's not actionable. And so when you say we're still risk on because of these reasons, I understand it. But it's like, you do know that at any point in time, as somebody who follows your stuff, that could change based upon the information and what activity happens in the market at that moment. And then it's okay to shift. So it's also not being scared to stay with something until it changes and trying to get way too far ahead of yourself, which is where I think a lot of people get a lot of times, Darius.
Yeah, no, I thank you for saying that, because you know, one of the things that we were coaching our clients in our community today, I was just helping them remind them that, hey, there are three ways you generally be wrong as an investor. You know, we lose lots of money as an investor. One is not identifying regime change and obviously not doing anything about it. Two is being materially late to regime change because you don't have a process that can spot it real time early enough for you to do something about it. Or what I think most investors are doing, what you're alluding to, Anthony, which is incorrectly anticipating regime change.
Exactly. Right?
Like if you're just consistently and incorrectly anticipating regime change, you have this fundamental view that dictates markets have to change from their current condition to price in that fundamental view so that you can make money. That's where a lot of investors are wrong, because the reality is most people suck at predicting the future. We know that. Most institutional investors suck at predicting the future. So what do you expect to do as a retail investor? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I mean, it's so true.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so the reality is one thing we can take advantage of as market participants is the fact that, you know, momentum is a real thing. Markets trend.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything else. They trend more so than they inflect and trend. And so the reality is we've built our entire risk management process, as we highlighted in that previous slide, to take advantage of market momentum, right? It's not my job to tell the market that it needs to be pricing in Goldilocks, or it needs to be pricing in reflation, or it needs to be pricing in inflation, or it needs to be pricing in deflation. If I want to make money as an investor, I can't tell the market what to do. I have to take advantage of what the market is doing. And that's how the money flows into my account.
I've always said you can't impose your will on the market. You'll never win.
I can impose my will on a lot of defensive linemen, man. Because I've been a two-time All-American left tackle. And I tell you what, you know, imposing your will on humans is a lot easier than imposing your will on the market. I can guarantee you that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. I mean, and as a short-term day trader who focuses mostly on technicals, one of the main reasons why I feel like your work is so helpful for people like myself is because it keeps me within the context of the environment. And if the technicals are supporting that still, like we see this pullback in the market, and I think to your work, and it's like, okay, it's still risk on, and I look at it as a puzzle, and the technicals might break down temporarily, but if they regain themselves and nothing has changed in that macro environment, that helps me better navigate on the short term, which really takes me to the next market that, you know, is really up for debate a lot lately. I've been seeing as to why gold is surging to all-time highs. What do you believe is the driving force behind this move in gold?
Yeah, I mean, in our opinion, it's as clear as day that it's geopolitical. This is a geopolitical bid in gold. I mean, historically, you know, gold tends to be inversely correlated. If you look at it on a full cycle basis, the two dominant drivers of gold in terms of, you know, being countercyclical drivers are U.S. dollar and the real interest rate, particularly the real 10-year TIPS yield. Those will be the dominant drivers on gold across multiple market cycles. Now, again, the drivers of gold are less stable than they are for most asset markets over time. So what can cause the gold price to go up or go down in any particular, you know, cross-section of data? It can be very different from another cross-section of data for gold, whereas for something like the S&P or the credit market, that's not as true. You know, what causes the stock market to go up is, you know, earnings and liquidity and things of that nature, whereas gold, it could be a lot of other different things that fluctuate over time. But going back to what's driving this gold price, the things that are most stable in the context of not being particularly stable in absolute terms, but the things that are most stable in terms of driving the gold price higher are declining dollar and declining real interest rates. And right now, both the dollar and real interest rates are trending higher alongside gold, which tells you that there is something else in this particular cross-section of data that is driving the gold price higher. In our opinion, that's very much the geopolitical bit. One of the things we did today was introduce in our options overlay product, was introduce a put spread collar on gold, because our model ultimately believes that, hey, you're in a risk-on reflation market regime. Gold should not be up on a rope here, especially now with, you know, 10-year real treasury yields having risen to the extent that they have, not with the dollar has risen to the extent that it has. So there's probably a big pullback on gold coming in the coming weeks, in our opinion. That doesn't mean you can't buy that dip, but we'd be very cautious here in the context of gold kind of breaking out on things that historically are not stable, like geopolitical bits.
So that's the differential. I mean, that's where I'm seeing the argument. A lot of people will say gold is a hedge against central banks, right? And then you look at what's happening and I say, well, the theme doesn't kind of fit in this current environment, right? And then you go and look at geopolitical headwinds. And I know that we said that there has been some, but they're heating up as of late, but this move in gold has been going on for longer than that. So I don't know if it's just anticipating that or what else is it? Because the move didn't just start as the Middle East starts to heat up. It's been going on longer. And so I guess I'm kind of curious, at what point in your models, or did you guys start to look at that and say, this is why gold is doing this and we have to factor that in because of X?
Yeah. So we do that on a daily basis in terms of when we refresh our positioning model of all the indicators that we have in our model, all the main drivers of asset markets, you know, things like, you know, the dollar, interest rates, you know, the S&P, you know, Bitcoin and the crypto market. Of the things that have been driving gold, it's been actually inversely correlated to U.S. liquidity, the more dominant thing, which makes very, very little sense. Obviously, it tells you that there is something that is not trackable that's driving the gold price higher. And so in our opinion, we call me lazy. I think the lazy thing to do is assign a geopolitical bit to it. But the reality is we're only doing that after having done quantitative research to understand that the things that typically drive gold are not driving gold at this current moment. So, you know, the one thing I will say is, if I can share my screen again, where we show our volatility adjusted momentum signal for gold. Gold has been neutral in the context of how our volatility adjusted momentum signal works. And so, just a quick background for those who may be unfamiliar, we don't only care about price momentum here because we know that volatility at phase transitions historically has been a leading indicator for price, both to the upside in price, but also to the downside in price and more forcefully to the downside in price. Vol tends to break out or break down faster than price momentum tends to break out or break down. And so that's kind of the key takeaway there and why we built the model that way. So what a bullish signal means in the context of this model suggests that, hey, price momentum is trending higher, and the volatility characteristics of that asset class are trending in a direction that support that positive price momentum. When the signal is bearish, that means the price momentum of the asset is trending lower, and the volatility characteristics of that asset are trending in a direction that supports that bearish price momentum. When an asset is neutral, it means that the price can be trending higher or lower, but that volatility is not confirming that uptrend or downtrend in price. And that's exactly what we're seeing in gold here. That doesn't mean that the uptrend in price doesn't exist. You can make money on the uptrend in price, but you need to know that historically, you know, particularly in assets like gold, and this is true in every asset, you know, we see it here in the dollar, we see it here in gold, we see it here in gold again, which is when you have these big run ups or run downs in the price in a neutral regime setting, they get retraced more forcefully, more quickly than, you know, your standard garden variety pullbacks in a bullish regime or your standard, you know, kind of rips in a bearish regime. And so that's something that investors need to be aware of, that, hey, you know, this is a kind of a dangerous setup to be chasing. You would like to chase it a lot more if it was actually bullish and the volatility characteristics were confirming that bullish price momentum. But because they're not, we would suggest that there's a decent amount of downside risk in gold over the, you know, short to medium term. Because again, you know, the things that historically would keep people buying the dip or keep people's position sizes, you know, unchanged in a pullback are just not there. That fundamental support is just not there.
What about silver and copper? I mean, I looked at the chart of copper before we came on today, and yet again, another, you know, new high just exploding. I mean, I know they're very different than gold, right? I mean, their use cases are pretty different, similar maybe in some ways, but what is the reasoning and the driving force behind their moves?
Yeah. So that, in our opinion, the driving force behind their moves is that we're in a risk on reflation market regime that's being driven by positive economic surprises, both domestically and globally, and also in simultaneous uptrends in U.S. and global liquidity. And those are the things that are contributing to the risk on reflation market regime, of which silver and copper are obvious beneficiaries of, going back to that table we showed in our process slide. And so both silver and copper are bullish from the perspective of volatility decimal momentum signal. They should be bullish in a risk on market regime. And so our discretionary risk management overlay is currently recommending a max long position in those types of exposures.
Interesting time, isn't it, Darius, when you look at what's happening there? I don't remember a time where you've seen these types of things happening, like silver and copper going up for different reasons than gold's going up. I'm not saying that they're ever very closely tied, but they're different drivers, right? But you're seeing these metals move up. You're seeing what's happening in rates. And there's just so many different things going on, all these crosswinds. I want to talk to you about if there are any specific, maybe long-term investment trends that maybe you're seeing that you're particularly bullish or bearish on.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the most obvious thing that we see on our screens today is the structural mispricing in the treasury market. From our opinion, you know, if you look at term premium in the treasury market, they're somewhere, you know, they're still slightly negative. The mean term premium over the long term in the treasury market is somewhere around 150 basis points. If you think about what could potentially drive term premium higher in the treasury market, you think about the, you know, kind of the advent of these sort of record fiscal deficits, you know, as a share of GDP on a non-recession or a certain non-recession, non-war basis. You know, it's very unusual to have such high budget deficits, particularly when the unemployment rate is as low as it is, you know, somewhere around, I want to say 3.8%. And so to me, the likelihood that we see a significant positive shock to supply in the treasury market over the coming decade is quite high from the perspective of our analysis of the forward turning. I'm sure you're familiar with Neil Howell, my former colleague and one of my mentors, his work on the forward turning and how that, you know, the generational cycles tend to produce geopolitical outcomes in the economy, social outcomes in the economy. You know, we took that work a step further and said, okay, what should you expect as an investor in a forward turning from the perspective of the economy, from the perspective of the policy response, and ultimately from the perspective of asset markets? And one of the key takeaways, one of the more salient takeaways was that, you know, the size of the government and the size of government debts tend to explode in a forward turning. And so I think investors need to be very serious and cognizant that, you know, even though CBO and Treasury and Jeff Gundlach and Sam Druckenmiller projections of, you know, where Treasury supply is going to be over the next, in the coming decade plus, they're very high, we would say take the over on those numbers in the context of what's likely to occur in the fourth turning from the perspective of, you know, something that could be as serious as a total U.S. getting involved in a total war. So that's one of the more longer term themes we're focused on. Ultimately, we expect this sort of era of fiscal dominance that is part and parcel with this forward turning regime to manifest its way into the Fed being forced to accept 3% inflation. Right now, you know, one of the things that's kept us structurally bullish, and we pivoted a little bit late back in January of 2023, not late relative to the average investor, but late relative to my, you know, track record on Wall Street being usually better than that. You know, back in January 2023, when we pivoted bullish, we understood, hey, that this is a Fed that is, you know, just structurally easier than it probably should be. The Fed put is not only back, but it may be even back in it with a vengeance, if you think about their response to the regional banking crisis. And so from our perspective, it's not very clear, but from our perspective, it's very clear. I don't know that it's very clear to the average investor yet, but we believe this is a Fed that when faced with the choice of 2% inflation and a recession or 3% inflation and a resilient economy, we think they're going to choose the latter 99 times out of 100. And that is structurally bullish for risk assets like stocks, credit, crypto, and commodities, and is structurally bearish for defensive assets like treasuries and the U.S. dollar. And so that doesn't mean that treasury and dollar are going to go down every day, every week, every month, every quarter, and all the rest of those assets are going to go up every day, every week, every month, every quarter. But I think as an investor, you need to understand that, hey, this is a Fed that's going to be forced to acquiesce to a higher nominal GDP environment than they're used to from a populist standpoint, because that's what the population will demand from a voting perspective. But there's also a Fed that's going to be forced to acquiesce to more treasury supply than they're probably expecting currently. And as a function of that, we're probably going to see, you know, financial repression, currency debasement, and things of that nature. So, you know, we are structurally long-term bulls on, you know, your average risk asset, your average financial asset relative to something like a treasury bond or relative to something like U.S. dollar, unit of U.S. dollars. Doesn't mean those things are going to go up. You know, the things that we like are going to go up every day long term. But I think, you know, you have to understand where you are in that grid regime cycle, that Goldilocks reflation, inflation, deflation cycle, so that, you know, when you're pivoting into a risk on market regime, okay, you know that, hey, I got to be taking these risks. I got to take advantage of this cyclical upswing. But when you're pivoting to that risk off market regime, you understand that, hey, you know, this trade, even though we're structurally bullish, it's probably not going to work for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months.
So thinking about those long-term trends, what regime would start to come into play to where those then would become current themes?
Yeah. So we're effectively arguing that the frequency of reflation market regimes will increase. You know, we've had a high frequency of Goldilocks market regimes and a high frequency of deflation market regimes. That's that Goldilocks is real growth accelerating with inflation declining. Deflation is real growth declining with inflation declining. That was kind of the pivot, back and forth pivot in the most previous era, you know, the post-crisis era, you know, basically oscillating between Goldilocks and deflation. Because of this era of fiscal dominance, this fort-turning populism that we continue to see in fiscal policy, and no matter who wins the election in November, we're going to continue to see fort-turning populism in fiscal policy. Both Biden and Trump are essentially the same in that regard. And so we think this is an era where the frequency of reflation market regimes, risk on reflation, the risk off inflation, which is, you know, similar to reflation, but, you know, it's risk off risk assets. You know, we think that frequency of those two regimes will increase relative to the frequency of Goldilocks and deflation. So that's like the main regime pivot that we're seeing from a structural perspective. But again, as an investor, it's not my job to say, I think we're going to be there by such and such a date. Therefore, you got to do this in your portfolio. If you want to make and save money along the way, you have to respect the path the market chooses to take to get to that outcome. And in my opinion, that's what we do here at 42 Macro, is identify the path that the market is choosing to take. And we're helping investors position their portfolios with the right factor bets to take advantage of that path that the market has been choosing to take. We know where it's going 5, 10 years from now, but we have to understand and respect that path. And so I think that's something we do a great job of keeping our clients on the right side of market risk because of that.
Yeah, you do a fantastic job at that. And you and I have had this discussion before about executing the path, right? If you want to be a good trader or an investor, it's about executing the path. It's not just about making a call so far out or even in the short term. You have to execute to get there. Because the market is never going to get there in a linear fashion. We know that much. Based on your experience, what advice would you give to the individual investors out there navigating this current difficult economic landscape?
Ooh, that's a great question, man. What advice? Humility and be dispassionate. You know, even today, I could tell in our own client base, you know, when I'm interacting with our clients in our community portal, or in our community dashboard, we have a client feature. A chat feature today. Our clients interact with me, and you know, just reminding investors that, hey, like, it's, you know, when you wake up to Iran bombing Israel, and, you know, it's a lot very easy to see 1% down day, see that headline, and go, oh my God, I got to do something different today. You know, this is a signal. I got to do something different today. But the one thing I would suggest is, okay, you know, if your primary risk management process, the process that got you into the positions, has not changed signal, you should not be changing your portfolio. You know, wake up, refresh the models, you know, read what you need to read and go back to your busy day. You know, don't feel like you need to make an investment decision every single time there's a new headline or every single time the market moves more than you quote unquote expected it to in a short interval of time. You know, that may be a signal, but most of the time it isn't. Most of the time it's bait. It's sucking you in to make the exact wrong decision at the worst possible time. And that's what markets do. The markets punish people who are emotional and passionate about what they're doing. You need to be unemotional and dispassionate if you want to consistently make money and protect gains in financial markets. And that's something that's the number one thing we sell to our clients is market timing with dispassionate execution.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And, you know, today is a special day for you. You know, I'm a huge fan of yours. Hard to find anyone more passionate about this business than you. And I've gotten to know you over the years. And tell everybody why today's a pretty special day for you and 42 Macro.
Well, I appreciate you, Anthony, man. You know, I would say your passion is very much up there, man. You know, I've learned a lot from you as well over the years. And, like, just in terms of Jackie Robinson Day, this is a big day for me personally. You know, so Jackie Robinson, obviously our company's name, 42 Macro, that's an ode to Jackie Robinson. It's really an ode to the a lifetime of poverty that he had to overcome. It's an ode to the institutionalized racism that he had to overcome to demonstrate the excellence that he demonstrated on a consistent basis. And those are two things that I've had to overcome personally with my story and my struggle to demonstrate the excellence that our clients see every day from us here at 42 Macro. So Jackie Robinson is one of my heroes and certainly obviously someone I feel strongly enough about to name our company after. So appreciate him. Grateful that it's Jackie Robinson Day. Happy Jackie Robinson Day to everyone out there. that believes in, you know, democratizing what it is that we're democratizing, which in our opinion with you, Anthony, as well, is the upper echelons of institutional risk management. You know, this is a very, very hard game. A lot of investors are deluded by TikTok and Instagram that thinking that this is easy. And there are times where it is easy, but for the most part, if you're trying to compound returns over time, and then more importantly, if you're a retail investor, you know, build a sizable enough of a retirement account so that you can retire on time and comfortably, you know, it's a hard thing to do. And you definitely need resources to do that at a high level so that you're not making terrible mistakes at the worst possible times. And so even if it's not with us, or if it's not with Anthony, I highly recommend you find someone that has a proven track record at helping investors do this in terms of achieving those investment objectives. So thanks again, Anthony, for having me on the show. Again, happy Jackie Robinson Day out there to everyone that believes in democratization, believes in having a little brown brother like myself. You know, I preach some knowledge to you guys. I appreciate you.
TD, not only are you one of the best macro guys out there, you're one of the best people. It's always an honor and privilege to have you on the show. I appreciate you so much. And thank you so much for shedding some light on what's happening in this difficult environment. You're the best, buddy. Thank you so much.
Likewise, Anthony. Likewise. And I appreciate you, man. I look forward to next time, brother.